When we moved out to Winfield, we knew some people that went to this church, and we thought they're really great people, faithful people. So Calvary introduced to us that a relationship with Christ can be personal, and it can be something that's active and interesting, that you can do things that serve and be a part of what God's doing in the world. And we slowly started to grow in that through the opportunities Calvary kind of presented to us in different ministries and stuff. I've always had a heart for working with students, youth. I'm energized by them. I like conversations with them. They're not as boring as adults are. They're so raw. They're finding out their own purpose, their own life, their own direction. They have more questions than answers. In 2011, Calvary did the first trip to Czech to do an English camp with a local church there and to support our missionaries that Calvary supports there. And they had asked me to go because they needed someone who liked students and would do music. And I thought, I can do that. It's easy. After the camp, I was talking with the local pastor who directed the camp. He got to know me that week, and he was just casually talking with me, and he said, "Josh, you know, those students, they kind of enjoyed being with you. I think that you come alive around them. You should think about being a missionary here." And I thought, oh, that's ridiculous. That's, you know, I just like being with students. That's not a reason to be a missionary. And he looked at me and he said, "Oh, yes, it is." And that was the seed in my head that began to grow, the kind of the dream that I could maybe do missions. Oh no, I can't do missions. There's no way I could do that. I'm not conditioned for that. That's not the trajectory of my life, but that started to grow over time. And the next year we did a trip to the camp. By the year after that, I was arranged to serve short term in Czech. I raised support, I got in training from Reach Global, and it's like suddenly I'm in Czech, serving for a short-term assignment for 14 months, working with that local church, working with the pastor, working with those kids, just deepening my relationships with them. And at the end of that, I knew in deep places in my heart that I need to serve here because I'm coming alive here, and I'm watching other people come alive here too. And that's confirmation of the dream that God gave me, the calling. I know nothing about this, being a missionary. I have no example in my life, really. You know, I don't know how to a network like this. I don't know how to talk to people, share my story all the time, put myself out there for being disappointed. That's new and it's transformative for me. I'm learning a lot about myself as I do that. And also just a main ingredient for that is time. It takes time to, for God to work that out, for relationships to grow, to find people that believe in me. And I kind of looked at God throughout the corner of my eye and thought, I thought you told me, you put in my heart, you want me to serve there long term. And now I got to fly back to the States and, you know, one more year is going to get knocked off my life. The first thing I think about with Joseph is, you know, he had a dream and he knew God was with him, but it wasn't clear what it was. And that's the same for me. Like I told you about the pastor, he put that idea in my head that I could serve there long term, but I didn't know what that meant. So part of the waiting is you're getting a clearer picture of what God's working out in you. And you're finding things inside of you you didn't know, like the passions. I found out the passions I have I didn't know I had before. I found some gifting in me I didn't know I had before. I found out some things I need to lose in my life I wasn't aware I needed to lose. For me, something that really helps me while I wait is the support of relationships around me. People that can confirm to me again and again, Josh, this is what God has called you to. It's going to happen in God's way, in God's timing. And to find ways to grow, to be useful, I guess, to stay faithful and channel your frustration into what's productive, into what's into what can bless, into what can give hope to someone else while you wait. And it takes a willingness to be faithful to what God is doing and what God is not doing that you'd rather him do, perhaps.
Yeah, you can give Josh a hand. If you see him around, please encourage him. You want to talk to him, hear his story. It's always powerful when people live on purpose, isn't it? When you see someone so young as Josh, and yet they're so determined because they know God is writing a story for their life, and they're saying, I'm going to live on purpose. What is your purpose? It's the question we've been asking these couple weeks. Well, look, last week, Mark Twain, he once said there are two significant days in a person's life. The day that we are born, that we know, that's easy. And the day we discover why God had put us here. And as followers of Christ, we know God has a purpose for our life. Are you walking in yours? Because when you have a purpose, just as Josh, as we're going to see in Joseph, having a purpose helps in this life. It gives us motivation. It helps see the future. It helps us to walk through the challenges of this life. It keeps us persevering and going. There's something about living on purpose. But our purposes are often tested. And as we're seeing in this section of the whole story, we see that sometimes God gives us a purpose, but there are a lot of tests that come in order to get there. God says there's a test of waiting, test of getting a support ready. But God meets us in the tests. And what we're going to see today in the story, in this life of this guy by the name of Joseph, that God's size blessing comes from God's size testing. That Joseph had a God-sized test, and maybe you have a God-sized test. And most of us, we say, I want a blessing, right? I want God to bless me. Many of us say, oh, I just want a little bit. Just give me a little bit. We're like, God, bring it, pour it on. But a God-sized blessing often comes after a God-sized testing. And maybe you're here this morning and you think, I thought God had a purpose. I thought I knew what God wanted for me, but somehow it's not coming the way I want, or it's being tested. And we're going to see from Joseph's life some things to do while we're walking through the tests of life. And we've been looking at the Bible. We're in this part where we talk about the people God has for a savior. And we've seen that there is this upper story and a lower story. The upper story of the Bible is just what God is doing, kind of from God's perspective, his big plan of creation. Humanity messed up in sin, and God has a plan of redemption. He's working it through. The lower story is the story of the Bible where we live. What God is doing to accomplish that big plan. And we saw that God created us for a relationship, but Adam and Eve said, we don't want God. We want to be our own God. We want another king. And sin came into the world and messed things up. Our relationship with God was hindered. But God gave this promise that's a thread throughout the whole of the Bible, that one day the son of a woman would come who would crush the head of Satan and defeat evil forever. And the Bible is a story of how God's doing that. And we saw that God said, I'm going to create a people. He came to Abraham and said, from you, your descendants, the Savior is going to come. He said, Abraham, I'm going to make you into a mighty nation. I'm going to bless you. Your name is going to be great. And through you, all the nations will be blessed because the Savior is going to come from you. He gave that promise God did to Abraham's son, Isaac. Isaac passed on that promise, and God reiterated it to a man by the name of Jacob. And Jacob has 12 sons and a daughter. And most of the book of Genesis, in fact, about 27% of Genesis is devoted to the story of Jacob's 12 sons, and particularly the man by the name of Joseph. And you wonder, why is that? Why is so much of this book of Genesis, this book of beginnings that we're finishing today, devoted to Joseph? I think it's to show us how we are to live in the lower story in light of the upper story. How do we live in light of the promise of the Savior and what he's going to do? And Joseph, we see, was the favorite of his dad. His brothers hated him because of that. The dad gave him a coat, said, you're the boss, you're going to rule. The brothers hated him all the more. Joseph had some dreams, and he had these dreams. Probably many kids have these dreams that my brothers are going to bow down before me. My mom and dad's going to bow down before me. The whole world's going to be at my feet. And the brothers hated him even more. So eventually, they were going to kill him, but they decided to sell him into slavery. And he goes a few days' journey down to Egypt. He becomes a servant in Potiphar's house. He rises in the ranks. He becomes second in command of that house, but God has more for him. He is falsely accused by Potiphar's wife, and Potiphar throws him in prison in his basement. There he meets some people. He stays there for about 7 years. He meets the cupbearer and the baker of the Pharaoh, the most important person in the world, probably the most powerful person. They have some dreams. Joseph understands the dreams. The baker's going to be convicted for a crime. The cupbearer's going to be restored. And the activities happen just as Joseph predicted. And as we left Joseph last week, we see that he says to the cupbearer, when you get to the Pharaoh, remember me. But the cupbearer forgot him. And maybe you feel forgotten. And maybe you feel like Joseph, that God's given you a dream, a plan, a purpose, you got a story, but it's all been derailed. It doesn't go as you planned. And even it's delayed. It seems like it is dead. But we have a God who loves to bring life out of dead things. And if you turn in your Bibles to Genesis chapter 41, we'll see what happens next. Because Joseph, from his perspective, it looks like God is silent and not doing anything. And maybe you're here this morning, you're thinking, I don't know what God has done. He's gone missing in my life. But he was very active. Listen, Genesis 41 verse 1, it says, when 2 full years had passed, Pharaoh had a dream. He was standing by the Nile, when out of the river there came 7 cows, sleek and fat, and they grazed among the reeds. And after them, 7 other cows, ugly and gaunt, came up out of the Nile, stood beside those on the riverbank. And the cows that were ugly and gaunt ate up the 7 sleek fat cows. Then Pharaoh woke up, whoa, and he fell asleep again. And he had a second dream. 7 heads of grain, healthy and good, were growing on a single stalk. After them, 7 other heads of grain sprouted, thin, scorched by the east wind. The thin heads of grain swallowed up the 7 healthy, full heads, and Pharaoh woke up. It had been a dream. And in the morning, his mind was troubled. There was no peace. So he sent for all the magicians and wise men of Egypt, and Pharaoh told them his dreams, but no one could interpret them. Then the chief cupbearer said to Pharaoh, Pharaoh, today I'm kind of reminded of my shortcomings, that time we had a falling out. Pharaoh was once angry with his servants. He imprisoned me and the chief baker in the house of the captain of the guard. Each of us had a dream on the same night. Each dream had a meaning of his own. And a young Hebrew was there with us, a servant of the captain of the guard. We told him our dreams. He interpreted them for us, giving each man the interpretation of his dreams. Now, Joseph is about 30 years old. It's been about 13 years since he's been sold into slavery, and he thinks maybe God's forgotten him, or it looks like everything's kind of the same, that God's not working in his life. His dreams certainly aren't coming to fruition. He asks the cupbearer to remember him, and the cupbearer seemingly has forgotten him, except even when God seems silent in our life, he is always working somewhere else, and he is very active in Pharaoh's life. Pharaoh has this dream, this crazy dream that seems to trouble him, so much so that he calls everybody in to try to understand and interpret it, and you think, kind of in hindsight, this one seems like an easy dream to interpret. And particularly in Egypt mythology, I mean, there was meaning and significance behind things. The number 7 in Egypt meant certainty. Things would definitely happen. This was a dream. That's why it troubled Pharaoh. Something is definitely going to happen. That the Nile River was a source of life. And life was important to people. And the cows were a symbol of Egypt. It was one of the symbols that there was something certainly going to happen that was going to strike at the very heart of life for Egypt. But for all their insight, none of the wise people knew how to understand the dream, because it wasn't just a normal dream. This was God working. God was at work in Pharaoh's life. And when no one could understand it, and Pharaoh was getting more troubled, the cupbearer finally fesses up. And he probably hasn't said anything about Joseph, because he doesn't want to break any equilibrium that's there. Pharaoh restored him from whatever had happened before. He doesn't want to remind Pharaoh of their kind of bad times. But finally he says, hey, Pharaoh, I know that there's a guy, a Hebrew, in prison who can help you. Can you imagine one morning Joseph wakes up in prison, and the next minute he's in the palace? This is our God, who at one time can totally change our circumstances. Joseph is up, he showers, he shaves, he goes and he stands before Pharaoh, and Pharaoh tells him his dream and says, hey, can you do something about it? Can you help me understand it? And Joseph says, well, I can't. Only God can do that. Only God can help you with that dream. And what you have to remember is in the Egyptian culture, Pharaoh was a god. That he treated people like a god, people believed that he was a god, and you can imagine, as Joseph is standing before the Pharaoh, all the advisors are trembling, thinking, this guy isn't going to last a minute, because he's just kind of insulted Pharaoh. Hey, Pharaoh, I know you think you're a god, and you treat people like that, but there's a God greater than you. I love Joseph's boldness. And notice what Pharaoh does not do. Pharaoh does not say, yeah, what kind of God? The kind of God that lets you rot in prison for 7 years? The kind of God that has you sold from your country? The kind of God that's falsely accused you? The kind of God that looks like he has left and abandoned you? That kind of God who doesn't look very powerful in your life is going to be powerful in my life because he's speaking to me? There was something about Joseph, even in the midst of his pain and suffering, that let others know the power of God. And friends, this is so important for us because sometimes, right, the enemy, what he wants to say is he says, look, you can't tell anybody anything. You can't testify about your God. Who are you to share about your God? Because look at your life. Your life is nowhere. It's not near what the dream that it should be. You have no right to speak. Here is Joseph. That it looked like God had completely left him. And he says, hey, Pharaoh, there is still a God who is speaking to you. And I want you to know about that God. And notice what he goes on. He says to Pharaoh in verse 16, he says, I cannot do it, Joseph replied to Pharaoh. I can't tell you, but God will give Pharaoh the answer he desires. In fact, that word for desire, it has kind of the sense of peace or satisfaction that this Pharaoh, well, I will give you the answer from God that will finally give you peace. And Pharaoh was all in because he had no peace. And here is the most powerful person on the planet at the day. Wealth and everything totally surrounded him. He had what the world would say was the world on a string, but he had no peace. And what did Joseph have? The remarkable thing about Joseph, why would Pharaoh listen to him? Because despite his situation and circumstances, despite what it was like living in the lower story, Joseph had what Pharaoh did not have, peace. Friends, one of the most powerful tools we have to share Jesus is the peace of Christ. What is Joseph saying? He says, I've got a good, good father. I know it does not look like it, but I have peace. And one of the most powerful spiritual gifts we can give to anyone is sharing peace. You're in a marriage and your spouse doesn't know Jesus, you just continue to walk in peace. Your parents, they don't know Jesus. You just walk in peace. Or people at your workplace do not know Jesus. Do not ever underestimate the power of walking in peace. Because one thing the world does not have, it cannot have peace without the peace of God and peace with God. And Joseph begins to share with Pharaoh what this dream is about. He says, you're going to have 7 years of plenty. There's going to be abundance, and that's going to be followed by 7 years of famine. And so what you need to do, Pharaoh, is store up 20% a year for the first 7 years, and then you can live off that for the following 7 years. And Pharaoh does something remarkable, is that he listens to Joseph. Now think about it. This is a Hebrew slave. It would take at least 8 years before anyone would ever know whether Joseph was right or not. Right? No one is ever going to know, was Joseph right in the interpretation? Did God really give him the interpretation for 8 years? Because there had to be 7 years of famine, or 7 years of plenty, and then a year of famine. And then notice what Joseph does. Not only does it say, hey, let me give you the interpretation of the dream. This is what God is doing. He's certainly doing it in your life. He's letting you know ahead, Pharaoh. He says, let me advise you on how to do that. He not only become the interpreter, he is now the advisor. You get one good person who's strong and mighty and wise and a good administrator and put him over this whole project of overseeing the acquisition and the distribution of the grain. And what does Pharaoh do? He says, you're the man. I don't know anyone in all of the country who can do it but Joseph. And think about it. He knew Joseph for what? 20 minutes? And he says, there's no one else as of Joseph. Why would he pick Joseph? Because I think Joseph walked in the peace of God, which is what Pharaoh needed. And friends, when we walk through the peace of God and walk with the peace of God, it speaks to people. And this is why a God-sized testing is so important, and it brings a God-sized blessing. And it's not just the testing that does that. Sometimes we think, well, I've had some big tests in my life. Tests don't necessarily bring a blessing. It's how we walk through those tests. The testing of our faith, James, it brings perseverance and hope and character and other things. And it's walking through the test. And Joseph did that. Pharaoh elevates Joseph to be second in command. He moves from second in command to from Potiphar's house, second in command of prison. Now he is second in command of all the country. Pharaoh gives him his daughter as a wife. He's married. He has two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. The word Ephraim, the name, means fruitful. I love that. Here is Joseph. After all these years of difficulty and testing, he says, God has made me fruitful. How does Genesis, the book, start? The first commandment God gives to Adam and Eve is what? Be fruitful. The first commandment God gave to Noah after restoring the earth, be fruitful. The book of Genesis ends with Joseph saying what? God has made me fruitful. Fruitful. And the second son is Manasseh. It's time of forgetting. Some translations say God has taken the sting out. And I love this because it gives us some insight that Joseph in his life, there was sting, there was pain, there was hurt. But through that time of testing, God had taken that away from him. Joseph says, God's made me fruitful. And he's taken the sting out. What do we learn? Because here Joseph finally sees his dream achieved. He's second in command. The world is bowing at his feet. What do we learn? First, we have to learn to trust in God's timetable. Right? God gave him a dream. God had to get him to Egypt. God had to get Egypt ready. God had to get Pharaoh ready. Imagine if the cupbearer had said to Pharaoh a couple of years earlier, oh, there's this dream interpreter who lives in prison. What do you want to know about him? Pharaoh would have no use for him, probably would have forgot him. But at just the right time, when Pharaoh needed Joseph, God elevated Joseph. His timing is perfect. Secondly, we have to, in times of testing, not just trust God's timetable, but trust his activity. Because it may seem like us for Joseph that God's not working. Maybe you come this morning and go, I don't know where God is. God's absent. He's missing in my life. He may not be working the way that you want him to, but maybe he is working in someone else's life to prepare for your future. Maybe you're not married because God's preparing your partner. Maybe you're not in the right job because God's preparing the company. As Josh said, maybe God doesn't have me yet on the mission field because God's doing some work in my life in the people who are over there. And thirdly, in times of testing, trust in God's presence. This is what Joseph did throughout all his testing. He leaned in and he said, I'm going to have a relationship with God. God was with him in Potiphar's house. God was with him in prison. He says, God is with me. And notice what Joseph does. This Joseph, who seemingly might have been easy to say, hey, God's not there. He goes before Pharaoh. Pharaoh says, will you interpret the dream for me? And what does Joseph not do? He does not say, hey, you know what? I used to be into dreams, but God's kind of let me down. Right? I'd love to, but you know what? I thought I knew interpretation of a dream, and it's just not working. Notice what he doesn't do. He doesn't say, hey, Pharaoh, you know, for $69.95, I'll interpret that dream. Throw in a couple other dreams and maybe I'll help you. He says, my good, good father will help me and give me the interpretation of that dream. And he knew that because he had leaned into God and he knew who God was. And Joseph leaned into God, trusted his timing, trusted God's timetable. And you would think that the time of testing for him was over. But Joseph was about to experience his greatest test as second in command.
See, I don't know, you may think, well, no, his greatest test being sold into slavery. No, his greatest test was being waiting and rotting in prison. No, no, no. His greatest test was, what do you do when you have all power and someone who has hurt you stands in front of you? That's a test. And sometimes our greatest tests come when people who have wounded us stand in front of us. And what do we do? Because now the scene, it turns not from Egypt, it turns back to Canaan, where there are 11 brothers, 10 of who are really struggling with guilt. And it turns back to a family that is completely broken, a family that cannot possibly be the leaders, the family that ushers in a Savior, a family who needs redemption, and a family who needs to be saved. And here we read in chapter 42, verse 1, that the famine had also hit them. And it says, when Jacob learned that there was grain in Egypt, he said to his sons, why do you just keep looking at each other? Why aren't you down there? He continued, I've heard that there is grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy some for us so that we may live and not die. And then 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain from Egypt, but Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with the others because he was afraid that harm may come to him. So Israel's sons were among those who went to buy grain, for the famine was great in the land of Canaan also. Now, do you get this picture? Here are these 10 brothers. They're starving. There is no food. They know that there is food in Egypt, but what are they not doing? They're staying away. They're not going there. You get the picture that the very last place they want to go is Egypt. Why? Because it's a symbol of their guilt. It's a reminder of their sin. It's a big place, but maybe they are afraid somehow, somewhere, they might run into their brother, although they probably hope or expect at this time, he's not even alive. It's 13 years, or actually it's now 22 years. It is 8 years after Joseph's at least been elevated. And finally, Jacob says, you got to go for the sake of the family. You got to go down to Egypt and get some grain. So very reluctantly, these guys go because they got to face their guilt. And yet it's only in facing their sin and their guilt that healing is going to come. And friends, there's often an Egypt for all of us. Because many of us have something that we've done, something we are undealt with, a sin that we have, something from our past that needs to be dealt with, something we've covered over, something that we're hiding, maybe a hurt, a habit, or hang up. For many of us, there is an Egypt. And the only way that we can experience healing and wholeness is going to Egypt. The only way that the brothers could actually experience real peace was by facing their past and getting forgiveness. And so they go. And my guess is the last person they expect to meet is Joseph. And Joseph, his second in command, is still watching over all the distribution of the food. Now that the harvest has all been in for 7 years, they're distributing to those who have need. And it just so happens that he's wandering around the bazaar, the marketplace. The brothers come and they bow down probably before him. And it says in verse 8, although Joseph recognized his brothers, they did not recognize him. Joseph now realizes his dream has come true, right? 10 of his brothers are bowing down before him, and then he remembered his dreams about them, and he said to them, you are spies. You've come to see where our land is unprotected. No, no, my Lord, they answered. Your servants have come to buy food. With all this, we are all the sons of one man. Your servants are honest men. Don't you love that? We are honest men, not spies. Now imagine you're Joseph. You have all the power in the world. You have incredible resources at your disposal. And the 10 people who have hurt you and shattered your life, caused you to be a slave, sent you away, separated you from your dad and your family, are there bowing before you. What do you do? How would you feel? Now, I think Joseph has already forgiven his brothers. I think he's already forgiven him in his heart, because he would not have had peace in front of Pharaoh. He would not have had the relationship with God. I think the bitterness would have got into his relationship with God throughout the whole thing. I think if he had not forgiven his brothers, by this point, he would have gone and chased them down. He knew where they were. Right? If he had not forgiven his brothers, he would have had all the means available to him to seek out revenge for them. He could have gone in and taken them out, proved to them that his dream was true. He did not do that. Why? Because I think deep down he wanted a relationship with him. I think that he had forgiven his brothers. Forgiveness, though, does not mean that what they did was not a big deal. It was a big deal. In fact, in chapter 50, he says it was evil. He says that's a big deal. It was evil. Does not mean that there's no pain. Does not mean that there aren't consequences for what they have done. I think that he had forgiven them because he was fruitful and God took the sting out. But there is a very big difference, friends, between forgiving someone and restoring that relationship. And here's where it gets often confusing. Because sometimes what people will say, well, if you really forgive me, we have to go back to the way things were. If you really forgive me, we just have to go back to kind of where things were before the hurt came in, and we've got to just be best friends. We got to have make sure that everything is okay. Forgiving is one thing that we have to do. The restoration of a relationship takes two people. And in order for a relationship to be restored, there has to be trust that is built between both people. And Joseph here, he says, okay, here are my brothers. I have forgiven them, but is there the basis there that our relationship can be restored? Or if I start to restore a relationship, are we just going to go back to the same old brothers and they're going to hurt me again and again and again and again? And Joseph does some crazy things. You're going to see that Joseph does some things. You may say, well, that just doesn't make sense. I think Joseph is against these brothers. He's not against them. He is trying to see, are they trustworthy? Is there enough change in their hearts and enough ownership of what they've done to restore the relationship? So what does he do? The first thing he does is what? He accuses them of being what? Spies. And then he throws them into prison. Before the brothers sold Joseph into slavery, what did the brothers say to Joseph? You're spying on us. And they threw him into a pit. And as soon as they get into the pit, the account continues, they begin to say to one another, and my guess is maybe Joseph heard this, they say, we are now receiving the penalty for our sin with our brother. They have not forgotten. and they're beginning to take ownership for it. Because what Joseph needs to know before he starts rebuilding this relationship is, are they really sorry? Have they repented? Have they changed?
Now you may say, well, why doesn't Joseph just reveal himself for who he is? Why doesn't he tell them, hey, I'm here? Because if he, the second in command, had said, hey, it's your brother, you sold into slavery, he would never know what? He would never know if they really changed because they had changed, or if they would act differently around him because he now had power and they could get something. He didn't want them to change or to act differently because of his position. He wanted to know, are they really changed? Is there an opportunity to start a relationship? So he puts them in prison. He sees that they have this godly sorrow. They're beginning to take ownership for it. He says, you got to keep, at first he says, nine of you have to stay. One of you has to go get your brother and bring him back. And then he changes his mind after 3 days. And he says, okay, nine of you can go. I'm going to let you go. But one has to stay until you bring your youngest brother, Benjamin, who they knew that the father would never let come with me. He wanted to see what kind of relationship they had with their dad. They go back, take the grain to Jacob. They open their sacks. They discover that all the money that they had taken to buy the grain was still in the sacks. They thought, oh no, Egypt's going to think that we're thieves. They tell their dad what they had done. One brother still in prison. They got to take Benjamin back. And Jacob panics, said, you can't do that. You can't take our son. He cannot go back with you. You get the sense that they try to make that grain last as long as they can. And you think of Jacob, you still got one son in Egyptian prison. Don't you really care? And finally, when there is no food, they head back to Egypt and they are able to take Benjamin. Jacob knows the only way we can have food is if Benjamin goes. And Reuben says, you can trust me, Dad. You can trust me. We'll look after him. They get down to Egypt. They tell the servants that there was money left from before. They brought extra. They said, we want to give it back. We want you to know we are honest people. And the servant says, well, that just must be a gift from God. They bring Benjamin before Joseph. And Joseph, I mean, does an amazing thing. He holds a banquet for them. And he gives Benjamin twice the food. Can you imagine? This was Joseph who was stuck in a pit without food or water while his brothers ate out in the fields. He now gives them food. He wants to see if he lavishes extra on Benjamin, will they be changed? Well, are they still the same jealousy there, or are they changed? Then they send them back home. He fills their sacks. Do you see the sense of grace? He shares a meal with them. He fills their sacks with food, but he places his gold cup in Benjamin's sack. After they've gone a little ways, he sends out his guards to check. He says, one of you stole my cup, and they look, and it's in Benjamin's sack. And they said, we got to take Benjamin back. We're going to put him in prison. He's a thief. He's a thief. And notice what Judah does. Judah, one of the sons, stands up and says, your servant guaranteed this boy's safety to my father in Genesis 44. I said, if I do not bring him back to you, I will bear the blame before you, my father, all my life. Now then, please, let your servant remain here as my Lord's slave in place of the boy. Let the boy return with his brothers. How can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? No, don't let me see the misery that would come on my father. And notice what happens. Judah takes Joseph's or Benjamin's place. He becomes like Jesus. He says, I'll take his place. You send Benjamin back. And Joseph can't handle it anymore. He sees a love for their father. They can't hurt their father. He sees a love for their brother. He sees that they are changed. And what does he say? He says, I know that there is enough trust and change to have a relationship restored. He tells them who he is. He lavishes them with more gifts. He says, the famine's only going to get worse. You move down here. You come to Egypt. He gives them carts to go and get the stuff. He gives them new clothes. He gives them a place to live.
And it's there in Egypt that Jacob's family is now safe to grow and multiply and become a nation outside of all the enemies in Canaan. And God's plan is coming to fruition. And it comes to fruition because Joseph had this test of what do you do when someone hurts? And he pours out grace upon them. Grace upon grace. In fact, so much so that even after Jacob, the dad, dies, let the brothers go to Joseph and say, hey, wait a minute. He said, wait a minute. Maybe you're only nice to us because of your dad and because of our dad. Maybe that's all it is. Now that he's gone, are you really going to come down on us? And in Genesis 50, verse 19, Joseph said to them, don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? I'm where God wants me to be, and I'm not in a place where I can judge like God. You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what's being done, the saving of many lives. So don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. And why did the brothers come back? Why are they worried? I think because they're a lot like us. They're not sure how to really receive forgiveness. And Joseph gave them forgiveness, and they're like, are we really worthy of it? Are we really sure? And how many times does God forgive us, and we, though, feel like, I don't deserve it. God's going to come and get me. I don't deserve it. And God continues to forgive and forgive. Let me ask you this morning, whose sacks do you need to fill? Who has wounded you? And maybe you need to forgive. Maybe you need to pour out blessing. See, some of us this morning, we feel like Joseph. That we know that we need that for God to overcome hurts. Some of us feel like the brothers. That there's someone we've hurt that we need to know there's forgiveness and restoration with. We're going to look at the book of Exodus next week, but I love how Genesis ends. It ends as it begins with blessing. The last two chapters of blessing. Two full chapters of blessing. The first thing God did for Adam is that he blessed him. God blessed Noah. God blessed Abraham. God blessed Isaac. God blessed Jacob. Jacob blesses Pharaoh. Jacob blesses his sons. In fact, in chapter 49, Joseph brings his sons to Jacob, the guy who wrestled a blessing from God. And God said to his sons, to Jacob's sons, he says to them, in the day Jacob blessed them, he said, in time to come, the people of Israel will use you as a blessing. They will say, may God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh. This is a blessing for the two of you that God's going to use for the rest of the story. May God make you what? Fruitful. And may God take the sting out. And do you know, to this day, in many homes, in many Jewish homes, every Sabbath meal, once a week, as the family sit down, the moms and dads will bless their kids with that same blessing. May God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh. May God make you fruitful, and may God take the sting out. Do you know what that does to a child? Do you know what that does when they receive a blessing every day, when they know they have a future and a hope? When their parent believes in them and says, be fruitful. I know God has a plan and a purpose for you. And I know in the pain of your life, God can take the sting out.